Welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast, where we develop and deliver the most engaging negotiation content and training in the world. We host negotiation experts, business people, and entrepreneurs, and discuss what works, what doesn't work, and how we can improve our negotiation skills. Hey, listeners, thank you so much for joining me on the Negotiations Ninja podcast. Today, we have an amazing guest. Her name is Dr. Jennifer Goldman Wetzler. She is the leader of an organization called the Alignment Strategies Group, and she is also a negotiation and conflict resolution professor at Columbia University. And she's written this amazing new book called Optimal Outcomes: Free Yourself from Conflict at Work, Home, and in Life. And we talk about that book today, as well as some of the strategies that she's developed for resolving conflict. We hit it off pretty good, and we had a fantastic conversation around conflict resolution, which is related to negotiation, definitely a part of it, but it's not necessarily negotiation in and of itself. I really, really enjoyed this discussion with her. I think you're going to enjoy it too. Enjoy. Hi, Jen. How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
I am splendid. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm really excited to have this conversation because we don't often talk a lot about conflict in this kind of detail. We've had a lot of negotiation experts, and many of them deal with conflict-based situations. But for you, I think this is sort of your specialty. But before we get into it, maybe you could tell the listeners a bit about yourself and what you do.
I am the CEO and founder of Alignment Strategies Group, a boutique consulting firm based in New York City, where we help leaders to develop their organizational capacity for health and growth. I also am an instructor at Columbia University. I teach conflict freedom, which is what the book that I wrote, Optimal Outcomes, is all about. And I look forward to telling you more about it.
Awesome. And you work with a friend of mine, Dr. Beth Fisher.
Yes, I do. That's right.
Wonderful. Yeah, she's amazing. I love that woman. Okay, let's get into it. I really want to know more about the book, and I really want to understand more about your work. But I figured the way that we could start off is by defining conflict and maybe sort of helping the listeners understand the difference between a conflict and a negotiation. Are they the same or are they different?
I think they're related. They're not exactly the same. And it may be that it's just the context or the content that matters. So I think about a negotiation as a kind of specific interaction, and a conflict might be broader. It might take longer to deal with. You know, the way I define conflict is pretty simple. It's just a situation where two or more people are not, you know, their needs are not being met, or they're just seeing a situation from different points of view. Pretty simple.
Yeah, I love that. And so when people are in a conflict-based situation and their needs are not being met, oftentimes they get frustrated and they get angry. They might lash out with ad hominem attacks or something like that. What do you see as the number one mistake that people make when faced with a conflict?
Well, the number one mistake that people make in conflict situations is responding the same way over and over again and expecting a different result.
The definition of insanity.
Right. That's exactly right. So in the book, what I do is I talk about four conflict habits that we tend to fall back on in conflict situations that recur again and again. We use them with the best of intentions, but we often get stuck because we're doing the same thing over and over again and expecting it to come out differently. So the four conflict habits, the first one is that we blame other people. Second one is that we avoid other people to the point of shutting down in the face of conflict. The third one is that some of us blame and shame our own selves. And the fourth one, perhaps a bit counterintuitive, is that we relentlessly seek to collaborate even when other people are not willing to cooperate back with us. And so each one of these we do again with the best of intentions, but they don't get us what we want. We may want to win the negotiation, but instead we end up blaming other people, or we may want to, you know, be seen as a collaborative partner or a collaborative leader and actually come to better outcomes. But when other people are not willing to collaborate with us, it doesn't work. What I recommend in these situations is to, first of all, notice what is your conflict habit and then ask yourself, what is something that I could do that would be different from engaging in this conflict habit? And so if people are interested, they can actually go online at optimaloutcomesbook.com/assessment, and you'll see the conflict habits assessment. You can take it. It takes like 7 minutes and it's totally free.
Why do you think that people avoid conflict? They avoid those types of situations. You mentioned one of the four common conflict habits is avoiding others. Why do they do that?
Again, you know, with good intentions. And in many situations, those good intentions do bear fruit. So it can be a real benefit to avoid conflict in certain situations. So if the issue is not that important, or the relationship or people that are involved are not that important to you, it can be a very smart thing to avoid getting into a situation that's just not that important with someone you don't really care about. But when you avoid situations in a habitual way, what tends to happen is that certain situations are important, or certain issues are important, or the relationship is an important one to you. And so then the conflict tends to kind of be bubbling up, and eventually it boils over and explodes. And then you have a real conflict on your hands that you simply can't avoid because it's just staring you in the face. And if you try to avoid it, it would basically be impossible. So that's why I think people do it, is because sometimes it can get us what we want. But when we're doing it all the time, regardless of what the situation calls for, that's when we get into trouble.
Is it a fear-based thing when people who do it habitually?
You know, not necessarily. Another way to answer the question of why do people avoid conflict is because that's how they've grown up, or we've grown up learning how to deal with conflict. So in the book, I talk a lot about what are the influencing factors that lead us to have the habits that we have. And so for many of us, you know, we grew up in a family where that's how conflict was dealt with. It wasn't dealt with. It was avoided. And we learned, again, that there can be positive outcomes to responding that way. And even if we grew up in a household, for example, if you grow up in a home where people yell and scream to get what they want, you may have learned from a young age how to do that. And you also may have learned, as I did, both how to do it and also that it's not particularly effective. But even if you're learning that it's not effective, you're still learning how to do it. And you know, in other families, you learn what you don't want to do. So you might have grown up in a family of screamers and door slammers like I did, and then decided for yourself, as I did eventually, that's not how I want to operate. I want to operate in a different way. But regardless, the way that we grow up, and it's not just about our parents, and it's not just about the home we grow up in, it's also about the messages we receive from coaches, from spiritual leaders, from community members, from teachers, and not only about that either, it's also about the cultural messages we get from watching TV or watching the news, etc.
Your family history is an interesting one. Maybe you could tell the listeners a bit about your family history.
We were a family of screamers who would yell at each other to get what we wanted. And I learned how to do that from a young age. That came from prior generations, right? I had a grandfather who had a very hot temper. And it was not until I got to be in college and had some distance from my family, I went away to school in Boston and from New York City originally, from the Bronx. And so having the physical distance and also being older, I was able to reflect and notice that, you know, my grandfather was an immigrant. He came here from Nazi Europe, where he had escaped in the middle of World War II to save his life. And he had left behind family members that he never saw again. So out of that pain, I believe, came deep rage, anger, and grief that he never was able to really appropriately deal with. Because as an immigrant, and as a result of the time that he was alive, you know, he didn't get the help that he needed to process those emotions. And so they came out in bouts of anger and rage that my father learned. And then, you know, I learned it from my father and from my grandfather, who lived across the street from us my whole childhood. You know, so that's how these things get passed down. So that's the kind of environment I grew up in on one side of my family. On the other side, I had Grandma Florence, who I now refer to as the first conflict whisperer that I knew. And she, just by her very presence, had the ability to calm everyone else in the family down. And so I think it was really this juxtaposition of growing up with a rage-filled grandfather and a grandmother who, on the other side of the family, had this real deep presence. And just by the sound of her voice and saying, shah, shah, which is her Yiddish way of saying, you know, shush, could calm everyone down. And so that's what I now seek to be in my own life for myself and for my clients and colleagues and friends, and also teach people how to do in the book that I wrote, Optimal Outcomes.
Now that you look back on her example, being that conflict whisperer, and you mentioned her presence and her voice, what was it about her that was able to calm everyone down?
Well, first of all, she didn't get caught up in all the yelling. So my family used to take trips every Sunday from our little apartment in the Bronx to the quote-unquote countryside, to Connecticut, where my uncle and aunt lived. And basically, my father would be driving, my mother would be in the front seat, my brother and I would be in the back seat, and Grandma Florence would be sitting in the middle of me and my brother. And it was like she was kind of in the eye of the storm. And this is, again, what I teach people to do now for themselves, is that you can be in the eye of a storm with people yelling at each other every which way. And you can build a presence by practicing over time. And that's why I call the work that I do as part of the Optimal Outcomes Method practices, because it takes practice to get good at them. It takes practice to learn how to do them well. So she, first of all, didn't get caught up in what was going on around her, and she maintained her presence regardless of what the rest of us were doing. And I think, you know, if you ask me, well, how did she do that, or why did she do that? I think some people have a knack for this, and I think she did. She was a very elegant woman, and it just wasn't in her nature. I can't remember a single time I ever heard her raise her voice at anyone. It just wasn't part of her personality. But, you know, it was certainly effective for us.
Amazing. And so it sounds like with her example, what you're saying is you're advocating the practice of learning how to deal with conflict by putting yourself in the eye of the storm. When you say you put yourself in the eye of the storm, that's where the calm exists, right? I mean, if we're going to use that analogy, that's where the calm exists in the storm, but everything that's crazy is going on around you. How do you propose that people stay within the eye and not necessarily get caught up in the storm around them?
Through 8 practices that I talk about in the book. So these practices are based on deep research that I've done over the span of 13 years on wisdom. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to be a wise person? What does it mean to be a wise leader? And these are also based on my experience teaching these practices over the span of also 13 years and refining and changing and implementing with clients all over the world in all kinds of leadership positions, from academic institutions to Fortune 500 companies and innovative nonprofits and innovative startups. So these are really practices that people can use to learn how to be that conflict whisperer. I wouldn't say that I would want you to have to be in the eye of the storm. These are practices to use when you find yourself in the storm of conflict. I wouldn't wish it on anybody, but the fact is that as we all know, right, as human beings, to think that we're not going to have any conflict in our lives means that we wouldn't be human if that were the case. So if you're human, you're going to experience conflict. And then the question is, how are you going to deal with it?
At a high level, what are those 8 practices?
The first one is notice. Notice your conflict habit, and also notice the pattern that you're stuck in with other people. So if you know what your habit is, and then you can ask yourself the question, what might their habit be out of those 4 that we talked about earlier? And then what's the pattern that my habit and their habit are interacting in? So if I am blaming and they're blaming back, we're in a blame pattern, for example. So just noticing my habit, asking myself what their habit might be. I could refer them to take the quiz online if I have a good enough relationship with them, or I can just take my best guess, and then noticing what's the pattern. So that's the first practice, is just noticing, because you can't break free from a pattern until you know what it is. The second practice is to map it out. So typically in recurring conflict situations, we're seeing the situation in black and white terms. It seems like it's about me and you, and there's no one else involved, when actually that's not usually the case. When a situation is recurring, it's typically pretty complex or more complex than that. So the mapping practice is all about putting more people on your map than immediately come to mind, and putting other factors on your map. Anything that influences or might be influenced by the situation in the past, present, or possible future, you put on your map and get creative. You can put colors on your map to denote certain things. You can put names of emotions on your map, anything that will help you tell the story of the situation in a different way.
Hey, Hey, listeners, I want to tell you about another company that I run called Content Callout. It is a thought leadership brand marketing company. Now, what does that mean? It means that we take you as an executive or entrepreneur, a leader of a small or medium-sized business, and we turn you into a thought leader online. We take your personal brand and we amp it up to 11. So that you can lead with confidence, knowing that people will recognize you, recognize your brand, and recognize your business because of the thought leadership approach that you've taken on social media through content creation and content distribution, as well as engaging with all of your following online. How do you get involved in this? Easy, easy, easy. Just go to contentcallout.com/get-started, and you will see there three different options that will allow you to take your thought leadership brand for yourself and for your business to the next level. We are super excited to talk to you about this. We've seen some massive growth with the businesses that we've been working with. Very, very exciting time for us. Look at that. We appreciate it. Now back to your show.
Practice three is about emotions and about how to use your emotions in your favor. So if you're someone who knows that you experience anger, it's about learning how to use that anger as a catalyst for constructive change. So if you think about, you know, the Martin Luther Kings and Gandhis and Nelson Mandelas and Rosa Parks of the world, they didn't never feel angry. They felt their anger and they asked themselves, what message is my anger sending me? Oftentimes, the message of anger is there's something not fair here. There's something not right, not just. So they would ask themselves, well, how can I constructively take action given that message? And that's what we saw those leaders that I just mentioned do. So my question for all of us is, how can we be the MLK juniors? How can we be the Gandhis? How can we be the Rosa Parkses of our own lives and use our emotions for constructive change? The next practice is values, and it's all about identifying our shadow values, those things that are really important to us inside, but that we would never admit are important to us, that drive our behavior anyway, and then exacerbate conflict and wreak havoc on our relationships with other people. So we can take a dive into that, because there's a lot more to say there.
Yeah, I actually do want to pause there for a second. When you say shadow values, the things that we don't necessarily express to others, how do we identify that in others?
How do you identify other people's shadow values, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. The funny thing is, our shadow values are typically hidden to us. These are things that we're pushing down, our own shadow values, and we're not willing to admit them. So we can't see them. It's like a blind spot for ourselves.
Right.
But if we take a moment to ask ourselves, if someone is acting in a way we don't like for example, I had a client who just was always pointing his finger at someone on his team who directly reported to him, saying, she's so selfish. I can't believe how selfish she is. So you want to kind of turn that around and ask yourself, what are they doing that's selfish? And why would they be acting that way? And ask yourself, what value might they have that they're not willing to admit to themselves that they have, but that might be driving their behavior? And in the book, I list about 8 or so different ways that people act that we find very displeasing and possible shadow values that might underlie them. So in this example, if someone is coming across to you as selfish, it may be that they care about independence or they care about autonomy, but they're having trouble admitting that. Right? So for you to acknowledge that they may care about autonomy, I mean, forget they can't admit it to you because they can't even admit it to themselves, can be really freeing for you. Right? You don't have to walk up to that person and then say, you know, I think you really care about autonomy, because how well is that conversation going to go? Probably not very. Right? But just knowing it for yourself, you might be able to give them the gift of acknowledging it in your actions or in your thoughts, right? To know, you know what? They really need autonomy. I, as their leader, as their manager, I'm going to do an experiment and see, what if I stop micromanaging them? What if I give them a little bit of freedom for a week and just see what happens? Maybe it'll help. So it can really open up things. But you don't have to do that, right? Because I've had people say, well, if I do that, then aren't I just rewarding this, you know, selfish seeming behavior? So you don't have to do that. But sometimes just even knowing it in your thoughts can allow your relationship with that person to shift and change and free you from a conflict you've been having with them.
Like every good negotiation trainer, it sounds like what you're saying is you've really got to be very curious about the conflict and why the conflict may be happening. So it sounds like you're advocating a lot of curiosity to find out what's actually going on here. And the labels that we give to people's emotions during these conflicts types of situations or their behavior during these types of situations, like you're saying, oh, this person is so selfish, that may not necessarily be true. It's the label that we're giving that person, but they may be behaving that way because of something completely different. And once we understand why they're behaving that way, then it becomes significantly more clear on how we can handle that type of situation.
Yes, that's right. And I would say this goes like a level deeper beyond just curiosity. It's curiosity about something that they couldn't even tell you themselves. Mm-hmm. And so I also recognize, and I like to let people know, you know, you may be wrong. You may think that they have a certain shadow value, and maybe you're wrong. But the fact is, you know, the payoff to guessing and having that curiosity is greater than the risk that you might incur if you're wrong. Because just your ability to wonder and take your best guess at what might be driving their behavior, even if you're wrong, raises your empathy for them in a way that very few other practices I know of can do. And it's that empathy that is the thing that really frees you. And you notice that I'm talking about freeing. So most other conflict methodologies are designed to help you try to resolve a conflict with other people. And what I'm talking about is situations where you've tried that. You've tried all those methodologies and they haven't worked. And that's why you're stuck in this recurring conflict. And especially for the listeners of your podcast, these are people who I presume are very seasoned negotiators. You're seasoned conflict resolvers and you know all the methodologies. And so this optimal outcomes method is all about what to do when everything else you've tried, all the principled win-win negotiation methodologies you know about have failed. So just raising your empathy for other people in this way can free you. Typically, when you free yourself, you've been stuck on a conflict loop and now you're free. There's no more loop, so they're free as well. But we're primarily concerned about what's going on for you to help you free yourself.
Brilliant. I know we've got other steps, but for the listeners, I'm going to hijack these steps for a second here because I want to take us a different direction. Let's maybe give the listeners some tactical advice on how they can manage a workplace conflict. Let's say, for example, they're the leader of a team that's stuck in a blaming pattern. How do we deal with that conflict? We want to basically stop the conflict to create a more cohesive work environment so that we can actually be productive. How do we deal with that kind of a situation?
Well, as I said, the first practice is to notice. And so whether you're noticing the habit that's happening for yourself as an individual, or you're noticing the habit that a team may be using, and I do, again, talk about in the book, these habits are used at all different levels of analysis. So we can have individuals using conflict habits with each other, and we can have teams using specific conflict habits with each other. And it is, you know, your example is a good one. And in the book, I do actually talk about a sales team that was in conflict with a particular person in the talent management function of a large global professional services firm. The talent manager was my client. And when he realized that the team he was dealing with was this hyper-competitive sales team, that they had a motto as part of their sales team that was, you know, triple sales or go home. Like they wanted to do three times as well as they did the year before. If they didn't, you know, that meant failure to them. This was a very competitive team. So it didn't really shock him when he realized that their team-wide conflict habit was that they would just kind of go in for the attack, because their need to compete, which is a positive habit that did help them, you know, make wins for their organization from a negotiation standpoint and a sales standpoint, when it became something that they relied on so much, they didn't know how to do anything different, it kind of warped into blaming other people and attacking other people. And that's how he felt, was blamed and attacked. So it can be very helpful for a team, for themselves. Now, this is an example where I'm saying someone else noticed that this team had a habit that they were collectively using, but we can notice that for our own teams. So the first thing is just to notice what is the group-wide or team-wide pattern that we might be stuck in, and then to ask people, how else could we do things? What else could we try out? How could we experiment? And you know, you could have your whole team take the 7-minute quiz online just to check and see, are there different people on the team that are typically their primary conflict habit is one thing or something else? Or are we as a team coming out using the same habit? It can be pretty fascinating to have that conversation.
I'm going to take us in the same direction, but slightly different. If you find someone in your team that is always seems to be the root cause of creating conflict, but they're a high performer. Whenever I hear Reed Hastings speak, for example, the head of Netflix, he talks about, you know, having no room for effective jerks, for example. Like, you may be a high performer, but if you're a jerk on my team, I'm going to cut you.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that? What's your methodology with that?
I'm in 1,000% agreement with Reed Hastings. And my reason why is because you actually undercut your team's ability to be effective as a team when you have someone on the team who is like a cancerous cell. I mean, though, that behavior that goes counter to whatever culture it is that you're trying to create spreads like wildfire. And first of all, it makes other people's work that much harder. So the one person who seems quote unquote effective, but is also a jerk, is making everyone else's lives more difficult. And also it sends a message to the rest of the team that this behavior is tolerated and they might start to act that way too. It's just a recipe for creating cultures that you don't want to create.
Very, very cool. Conflict's inevitable. I mean, we can't go through life without thinking that at some point we're going to get into conflict. And there are many of us that would rather avoid conflict just as a general rule of thumb, or try to avoid conflict because they just hate conflict situations. Knowing that conflict is inevitable, what do we say to these people that, you know, try their very best to avoid conflict?
The main thing I say is it's a great tool in your toolbox to use in situations where you think it can be effective. You just want to stay present and intentional. So if you are using avoidance as a tool because you think it's going to be particularly effective in a certain situation, because it's an issue you don't really care about or it's a person you don't really care much about, great. But if you find that you are habitually avoiding, you want to ask yourself, yeah, I'm going to start to sound like a broken record. You want to ask yourself, what else could I do instead?
How do they develop the courage, though? Because these people are stuck in this kind of a position because they've probably got this belief pattern that exists for whatever reason that conflict is bad or whatever it might be, right? So a lot of them lack the courage to be able to even take that first step,
right?
To even understand, okay, how could I do this differently? How do they build that courage?
Well, you just named it. I mean, that is the thing. So this methodology that I'm proposing is not for the weak. It is not for the weary. It is not for people who aren't able to gather that courage. This is a methodology that is going to require immense amounts of courage and personal change.
Wait, you mean we have to change in order to get better? Ridiculous.
Right. Exactly. That's it. That's the thing. The thing that so gets to me about so much of the win-win negotiation methodology out there is that some of us view it as it's a way out. You know, if the other person won't agree with us, then what am I going to do? Oh, well, you know, woe is me. There's nothing I can do. I'm going to have to either walk away or just stay in this terrible situation and grit my teeth and bear it. And the beauty of the optimal outcomes method is that I am saying to you, you don't need anyone else's cooperation.
Yes.
But in order for that to be true, that you don't need their cooperation, you do need an immense amount of courage and the willingness to practice, the willingness to experiment, the willingness to
motherable skill.
I'm going to do this over and over again until I keep learning. I mean, that's all it is. I'm just going to keep on feeding back the learning that I get from my experimentations and then build that into my next experiment and then try that.
Yeah. And then eventually it becomes a positive feedback loop.
Eventually. Yes. And for some people, it happens faster than for others. And in certain situations, it happens faster than in other situations. But absolutely, if you do not have the courage and the willingness to get completely out of your comfort zone, this is not the practice for you.
I'm glad that you don't like win-win, because I think win-win's bullshit too. I think it's nonsense.
Well, I want to clarify. It's not that I don't like it. And in fact, I have spent the last 20 years teaching win-win methodology all around the world. And I come out of the program on negotiation at Harvard Law School, and I have many colleagues who are still there teaching the methodology, and I still do. It's just that it is limited in its applicability. And there are situations where it works beautifully. And we've seen that all around the world, in the Middle East. We've seen that in business negotiations. So it absolutely can work. And as you are rightly pointing out, and I'm not surprised to hear you say what you just said, it doesn't always work, right? Yes. And the idea that we should always be able to collaborate with each other is just total bullshit, right?
Yes.
And to be able to call that what it is and then say, when the collaboration doesn't work, try something else instead. Stop banging your head up against a wall thinking there's something wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with you. The only thing wrong with you is that you're doing the same thing again and again, expecting a different result. And that's
the great thing about your methodology is that you're not saying there's only one methodology, right? When you get into a situation where one way isn't working, obviously either you have to change or you've got to walk away from the situation, because this is never going to work out. Trying to bang your head against a wall repeatedly is only going to result in blood, right? So you've got to find a way to get to something that makes sense and try a new methodology. Otherwise, it's never going to change. And that's the thing that I love about your approach, is that it's by nature just so curious to find out how we can apply new ideas, new methodologies to see what works in conflict-based situations. Otherwise, you're just going to be continually banging your head against the wall. And that's just brilliant. Thank you so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark. It's great to be in conversation with you and with your listeners who have so many years of experience.
Are all going to be interested in where they can buy your book and find more about you online. So how do they do that?
Well, the best way to learn more about this is to go to optimaloutcomesbook.com. There's a ton of free resources there. And then the book is for sale everywhere that books are being sold. So it's on Kindle, on Audible, on Amazon, and everywhere else books are sold.
Well, Jen, thank you so much for being on again. It was a great pleasure. For the listeners, just so that you know, I will be linking out to all of Jen's links on social, as well as where to buy her book. It was a great pleasure having her on. I highly recommend that you pick up her book. Thank you for joining us. Hey friends, thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and colleagues so that they can benefit from it as well. If you find Negotiations Ninja Podcast worthy, please go onto iTunes and give us a cool rating with a nice review. We certainly appreciate every single one that we get, because it helps us to understand who is listening, how they're listening, and what it is they like. If there's something that you would like me to discuss around negotiation, influence, or persuasion, give me a shout. You know how to reach me on social media, or you can get me on my website, which is www.negotiations.ninja.